I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome back to Radio Times. Marijuana is legal in 23 states, plus the District of Columbia, for medical and recreational use. And yet, it's still classified as a Schedule I drug, just like heroin. Seems the country has a rather schizophrenic view towards this plant. Our guest, David Casserette, scoffed at the idea that marijuana could be used to treat medical conditions until he had a patient who had impressed him with her knowledge of medicinal pot. He embarked on a learning expedition of a sort to educate himself about its uses and its misuses. The result is his new book called Stoned, A Doctor's Case for Medical Marijuana. David Casserette is a palliative care physician here in Philadelphia, also a researcher and professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine. And David Casserette has been a guest several times on Radio Times. Nice to have you back on the show.
Thanks. Great to be back.
Let's begin with you and your back. You had some pretty serious and sound like pretty painful back problems and decided to use marijuana to see if it would help. What happened?
Well, you're right, I did. And this episode happened about midway through the book writing process. So I had begun at that point to begin to be at least a little bit more open-minded about the potential medical benefits of medical marijuana. And so when I torqued my back getting into a little convertible, which is now passed on, sold on eBay, long gone, I developed the sort of acute back pain that those of us in middle age have come to know and expect. Awful spasms, horrendous pain. And I had a friend of a friend of a friend who provided me with a supply because medical marijuana is not legal in Pennsylvania. And it helped a bit. I mean, there was some relief.
You got some relief from
relief
the spasms?
Pain. But the real reason I told that story was I'm not a recreational user, have no experience, really haven't used, I think, probably since college, had no idea what I was doing. And I think what I did is called in marijuana circles over-toking. So I took a little bit too much with the result of having a lot of confusion, a lot of disorientation.
And maybe even hallucinations?
I became convinced that I was hearing air traffic controllers in my living room, where I'm pretty sure there weren't any air traffic controllers. And I think the lesson there is not that marijuana is dangerous or even that it's deadly. You can't actually overdose fatally on medical marijuana. But the real lesson for me there was if people are using it medically, as many of the patients I spoke with are, and they don't have any experience as recreational users, they don't really know what they're doing necessarily. And testing, figuring out what's in what you're about to smoke or eat really is essential.
I mean, is it about dosage? I do want to talk about what is in marijuana because you tease some of that apart. But is it also about dosage, which, you know, probably varies from dispensary to dispensary, maybe even from state to state?
It varies a lot depending on where you buy it and who you buy it from. It's also increased over time. So the concentration of THC, tetrahydrocannabinol, which is the active ingredient, if you will, it's certainly not the only active ingredient, but it's the ingredient in marijuana that makes you feel high. Other cannabinoids might have other effects, but they don't give you that feeling. The average THC concentration in marijuana that's been found by police and confiscated has increased over the last 15, 20 years from about 3% up to about 8, 9, 10%, which means that there's a huge variation in what you might be getting.
But you also seem to indicate, even beyond your back, but also looking at some of the other uses of marijuana, is that it seems to have some effectiveness with things like nerve pain. Yes?
Yes.
Did I read that right?
You did, and that was a big surprise to me. I thought that the benefits of medical marijuana, if there were, would be just the euphoria, right? It would make you feel good. But it turns out there really are medical effects, and those medical effects come partly from THC, partly from cannabidiol, or CBD, which is the other main ingredient. And some of the best data actually come from the treatment of neuropathic pain. There have been several good randomized controlled trials that have found that smoked marijuana containing THC and CBD can be effective in reducing pain due to neuropathic pain, which is pain that's caused by an injury to the nerve itself, as opposed to regular pain from, say, a broken leg that's caused by
arthritis or something like that.
Stimulation of a normal nerve. This is a problem with the nerve itself that can happen after chemotherapy with conditions like diabetes, sometimes lupus or other autoimmune diseases.
You mentioned THC. That's where the, I guess, the euphoria comes from that.
Exactly.
And the other one, CBD, B as in boy, D as in dog. How does that work?
It's fascinating. We're not really sure. It's become, I describe it in the book, as kind of the quiet cousin to THC. THC is the molecule, the cannabinoid in marijuana that gets all the attention because it's pretty obvious what it does. It makes you stoned. CBD doesn't have any psychoactive effects. So even in studies that have given people really massive doses, 500-600 milligrams of CBD, people don't get euphoric. They don't get stoned. And so people didn't really imagine that it might have some sort of medical effect. Huh. What does it do? We're not really sure. There's some evidence that it's responsible for part of the effectiveness in neuropathic pain. In fact, Barth Wilsey, who is a researcher and anesthesiologist that I talked to in researching stoned, has become increasingly interested in the possibility that some of his studies that have found benefits of marijuana on neuropathic pain, those benefits might actually come as much from CBD as from THC, or maybe even more. Huh. So he's doing trials now that decrease the amount of THC, increase the amount of CBD.
Well, is there, though, the relief that you get from euphoria, the THC part of marijuana, which is maybe you care less or you're less sort of anxious about how you feel, so you get some relief from it?
That might be part of it, sure. And I think one challenge to all of this research is it's hard to tease apart what these various cannabinoids do. There are dozens of cannabinoids in a marijuana plant. And so when you smoke a bud from that plant, you're getting THC and CBD in varying amounts, and you're getting a lot of other stuff too. So it's hard to tell what those effects are. But some of those effects probably are euphoria. But the effects related to CBD are probably independent of just feeling good. Mm. There's probably something real there, we think.
You tell a number of interesting stories, including one about a young girl named Randy who developed severe seizures that happened many, many times a day. Her parents were beside themselves trying to figure out what was the cause and how to treat it, and they turned to marijuana. Tell us that story.
They did, although they didn't exactly turn to marijuana. That's another CBD cannabidiol success story. So Cal and Cindy, Randy's parents, I met Cal actually in a dispensary outside of San Diego, and he told me he was buying marijuana products for somebody else. And I didn't really believe that, but it turned out to actually be true. And he invited me to their home, and I met Randy. So Randy, when she was only a few months old, started having severe seizures. Pediatric seizures, pediatric epilepsy, was diagnosed as having Dravet syndrome. And Cal and Cindy saw many neurologists, try multiple drugs. Meanwhile, Randy's seizures kept getting worse and worse to the point where she was having sometimes 6, 7, 8, a dozen seizures a day.
Wow.
With significant consequences both to her mental development and to her health. And so they turned not to marijuana, but to a very concentrated CBD oil. So oil that's given in small drops with very, very high concentrations of CBD. Again, that's the cannabinoid, one of the cannabinoids that doesn't make you euphoric. So it's not like Randy was getting high or stoned. There are really no more psychoactive effects to CBD than there are, say, for aspirin. Mm. But they saw her seizures go, they said, from 10 or 12 a day down to 1 a week. I should be clear, we don't actually know whether that works. There's a lot of anecdotal evidence. I spent some time talking to Oren Dubinsky, who's an epilepsy researcher at NYU. He's actually doing a clinical trial of CBD oil, which should provide results in the next year. So then we'll know for sure.
Well, it's interesting. You talk about the anecdotes, and there are many of them in this book, and many of them very compelling. But anecdotes are not research. And yet, I think you hear a story like that, and you think, wow, you know, this kind of oil with this CBD, that's got to be effective for other people besides this little girl named Randy.
You do. And I think that's a big challenge, I think, for people who are both patients who need relief, but also for physicians and researchers. There are a lot of stories out there. And some of those stories cover things for which there really doesn't seem to be any evidence whatsoever, like curing cancer.
Mm-hmm.
So the challenge, I think, for researchers, physicians, and patients is trying to tease apart which of these anecdotes are worth following up with clinical trials and which of them are probably lower priority. But lots and lots of stories.
Well, does it also complicate it that marijuana is still considered to be a Schedule I drug? I mean, as far as the federal government is concerned, it's basically an illegal drug.
Which is a huge challenge for researchers and then, by extension, for patients. If it's an illegal drug, it's hard to do research. And if it's an illegal drug, the federal government isn't going to fund therapeutic trials. And there's sort of a catch-22. One of the elements of a definition of a Schedule I substance is a substance that has risks that offers no benefits.
Right.
You can't really demonstrate that it has benefits unless you do clinical trials, but the federal government isn't going to fund clinical trials. We're kind of stuck.
Your book is subtitled A Doctor's Case for Medical Marijuana, and having read the book, I mean, that's not exactly what this book is about. But are you saying that we should do more research, certainly on medical marijuana, and try to follow up on some of these anecdotes to see if it's true or not?
Absolutely. I was asked actually to give a congressional briefing last week by Representative Blumenauer's office, not about medical marijuana or ethics or law, but about the need for more and better research. And the argument that I was given in being asked to give that briefing was that's something that the representative's office thought that everybody in Congress should be able to get behind. And not just research on benefits. So we certainly need clinical trials on benefits, but we also need to understand a lot more about potential risks.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the risk studies out there have been done on recreational marijuana users. And to say, for instance, that a kid who's in his 20s who uses marijuana 3 or 4 times a week with a lot of other drugs at parties may be more likely to develop psychiatric illness, maybe. But to say then that an administrative assistant at the University of Pennsylvania who uses it once a week to get to sleep, is she really going to have the same outcomes? We just don't know. So we know very, very little about the risks of medical marijuana use, and we need to know more.
You mentioned someone trying to get to sleep, and it seems that there has been some effectiveness with insomnia.
There's been a little bit, although it comes from an odd direction. The data on insomnia come mostly from studies of other symptoms. So lots of studies of marijuana on, say, pain or nausea that have, as almost a positive side effect, shown improved sleep. Is that because it has an effect on sleep, or is that because it's treating the pain or the nausea or muscle spasms that are preventing people from getting to sleep?
And we're almost having a break here. Is marijuana any harder or easier to study than any other drug?
It's a little bit harder in the sense that it's an illegal substance.
Yes, but even beyond that, just as a drug itself, as a chemical.
Yeah, one of the biggest challenges is that it's not a chemical, right?
Ah,
I mean, marijuana is a collection of chemicals. And that's the way you phrase that is perfect, because that's what makes it so difficult. You may do a study, I may do a study, but if we're studying different strains of marijuana with different components, we may get different results.
Well, let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's David Cassaret, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's a palliative care physician here in Philadelphia, and he's the author of a new book. It's titled Stoned, and it's subtitled A Doctor's Case for Medical Marijuana. And he's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine, also a researcher, and we've been talking about some of his findings, some of his experiences doing research for this book. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes at whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Just a recap here, our guest, physician David Cassaret, was pretty skeptical that marijuana could treat things like illnesses and physical ailments and even mental conditions until he decided to find out for himself what was going on. He spoke with researchers and marijuana users, dispensary workers, doctors, patients for his new book. And again, it's called Stoned, A Doctor's Case for Medical Marijuana. Going back to a couple of conditions where medical marijuana seems to have some positive effect. One is the nausea associated with chemotherapy. What do we know, or what do researchers know about that?
Well, we either know a lot or very little, depending on who you talk with. There really haven't been many good studies of smoked marijuana or vaporized marijuana, another form, for nausea associated with chemotherapy. Most of the data come from other cannabinoids, so sometimes synthetic cannabinoids like nabilone, which was created in the 70s. And I think many people who are skeptics would say, well, we haven't had good studies of smoked marijuana for nausea, so we don't know whether it works. But other people, and I think I'm among them, would say, well, we know enough about this class of drugs called cannabinoids to be able to say with some degree of certainty that it probably works. So I would say that the evidence for nausea is probably as good as it is for anything else right now.
Does anyone know why it is effective or could be? I'm using words very cautiously. You know, could be effective with nausea.
Yes, I think there are a couple of ideas. It's a bit of a puzzle, though. One of the neat things about cannabinoids is their cannabinoid receptors, so-called CB1 and CB2 receptors. There are other ones, but those are the big ones, all over the brain. The one area where there don't seem to be any THC or CBD receptors in the brain is in the brainstem. It's the lower part of the brain. And that's interesting because that's the part of the brain that controls nausea and vomiting. So how could it be effective if there are no receptors in the part of the brain that handles that? There are a bunch of theories. One of those theories, though, is that one of the pathways, if you will, I mean, there are a number of ways in which you become nauseated. One is through the middle ear when you feel vertigo, confusion.
Right.
Another pathway is through the GI tract, through hormones that are released. And it may be that some combination of THC and CBD interact with the hormones that are produced with the GI tract. That's actually the way that chemotherapy, the pathway that chemotherapy uses to make you feel nauseated. And that's, I think, a hypothesis of how marijuana might work.
Does it explain the munchies or even sometimes people having chemotherapy feel as if they've lost their appetite, believing that some marijuana could bring that appetite back? Does it actually work that way from what you know?
It does seem to, with one big caveat. So there have been many studies using either smoked marijuana or components of marijuana. THC is marketed under the trade name Marinol, dronabinol, which is a Schedule 3 substance, and it's available by prescription. That's the cannabinoid that has the most data for the use in anorexia, so loss of appetite and weight loss in advanced cancer and AIDS. It does, and other conditions, it does seem to work. It does seem to improve appetite. It doesn't seem to result, at least my read of the literature, it doesn't seem to result in weight gain. So for people who are losing weight, it wouldn't turn that train around. But often, for many of the patients I talk with, that's enough. Just having an appetite, being able to sit down with families for meals, that's enough for them.
You have a chapter in here where you go to a doctor who prescribes marijuana, and I have to say your description sounded kind of loosey-goosey in terms of the office itself, the interactions you had with this physician. What happened there?
Well, I at that point in writing the book, I had begun to realize that medical marijuana has some real potential benefits and some real potential risks. And I was curious about what sorts of advice patients were getting. I mean, how were they given information about how to balance those risks and benefits? And that was one example. But I actually went to several dispensaries and clinics in California and Colorado to get a sense of what patients were being told.
Posing as a patient.
You said I described that visit to a doctor. You may give him more credit than he deserves. I never saw a medical license. It's entirely possible he wasn't the doctor at all.
Okay. My assumption there. Right.
Mine too. And that was, but who knows? So there are these so-called pill mills, or the marijuana equivalent of pill mills, that have set up in a variety of locations, including touristy locations like Venice Beach in California, where you can walk in and for $30 get a letter of recommendation that will let you buy marijuana with no medical advice whatsoever. I should say
a medical exam or anything like
exactly.
that.
Exactly. There are, I think, clinicians, though, and I interviewed several of them, who take this very, very seriously as my internist colleagues would. They would take a history, they would do a physical exam, and they would provide that kind of information. So I don't want to give the impression that everybody who gets medical marijuana recommendations goes to that sort of fly-by-night operation. But they are pretty common, I think.
Well, and it's not like there aren't fly-by-night operations in sort of, the regular medical care. You did spend some time, as you said, in some dispensaries. I mean, what is that like, and how were you treated there?
Very differently than I was in the clinic. And I'm glad you asked that, because that was really eye-opening to me. I met a patient who at one of the clinics who then took me to the dispensary that she went to actually buy the marijuana once she had a letter of recommendation. And again, there are probably some dispensaries that are more sleazy or fly-by-night organizations. Mm-hmm. There's a huge variability. But the dispensaries that I was fortunate to go to, again, and mostly in Colorado, Oregon, and California, really were very much full-service operations with staff members who really took the time to explain things. Also, patients, customers who would hang out there and talk with each other. It was, I describe it in the book as being a combination of a clinic and a pharmacy and a block party and a support group all rolled into one.
I mean, a very different kind of experience than you might get at a pharmacy, for instance.
At a pharmacy or a regular medical clinic. I think a lot of people were finding that needs were being met, needs for social support, needs for advice and education, needs for symptom management. We're finding those needs being met at some clinics and some dispensaries in ways that they hadn't been met in their doctor's clinic.
In fact, you had a piece recently in the New York Times basically saying perhaps there are some lessons from these dispensaries that can be applied to the medical world in terms of taking time with people, sharing information, feeling as if you're being heard.
I think that's true, and that's hardly a revolutionary statement. The idea,
but it's interesting to take your experience there and say, you know, there's a reason these people are here besides just that they want marijuana. They're getting something else.
That's true. And I think many people ask me why on a national level there are now 23 states and the District of Columbia in which medical marijuana is legal, whereas it's still a Schedule I substance and there really haven't been at least as many randomized control trials as you'd think, given that there are at least 1 million registered users. And one explanation for that is that I think there's been a groundswell of enthusiasm, at least in part because people are not getting their needs met by their clinics, their hospitals, and their doctors. And so the enthusiasm for medical marijuana may have outstripped the data. That's probably a fair criticism. But that criticism can also be turned around and leveled at the medical establishment. I think we're not necessarily meeting our patients' needs as much as we could be.
Let me quickly reintroduce you. That's David Cassaret, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine. He's a palliative care physician, also a researcher, and he's an author. The book is called Stoned, A Doctor's Case for Medical Marijuana. And we have some open lines at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. Let me get Nancy from, looks like Bethlehem, to join us. Hi, Nancy. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
I'm calling in because I think that a lot of interesting points have been raised about some of the possible benefits of medical marijuana. But I couldn't help but think about the fact that we are prescribing opiates at a very high rate. There certainly have been some positive medical benefits from opiates that have been proven and are used. And we also now have a raging heroin epidemic. And some of that is directly tied to people who are prescribed opiates for pain and, you know, when their prescription ran out, found that it was no longer possible to get a drug that they became addicted to. I understand that marijuana is not heroin.
Sure.
But I just, you know, I think it's worth a momentary pause and a caution to think about some potential unintended consequences of some of these drugs that get introduced into the medical arena and how that might impact other people and going forward.
Sure, Nancy, it's a great point. And David Cassaret, go ahead.
Yeah, that's a great point. Thanks. And I think it's worth more than just a momentary pause. I think it's worth some careful thought and some serious reflection. I actually spend the better part of a chapter in Stoned talking about the risks of addiction, just to use that as one example, and spend some time talking with researchers here at the University of Pennsylvania, actually, who study marijuana addiction. And I'll confess, there were a lot of surprises to me in writing Stoned, but one of them was that marijuana is addictive. I didn't really think it was, or if it was, it certainly isn't addictive in the same way that alcohol or cocaine or heroin are, but it turns out that's true. And to the caller's point, their estimates, as well as other estimates that are available in the literature, suggest that roughly, give or take, maybe 1 in 10 people who use marijuana regularly will become dependent, will become addicted.
Is that typical for alcohol as well? I mean, is it sort of the same rate of addiction?
In the ballpark. I think cocaine is a little bit higher. Nicotine might be a little bit lower, depending on who you talk to. The point, though, I think, is that if you double the number of people who are using marijuana medically, if you believe that 1 in 10 number, more or less, you're going to double the number of people who become dependent. Mm. And if you're talking about 10 or 20 people, it's not a big deal. But if you're talking about potentially millions, then the caller's point is very well taken. And one of the arguments I make in Stoned is that we need to think about that. Mm-hmm. It's certainly safer than opioids. You can't fatally overdose. In fact, there's some evidence that in states that have legalized marijuana, fatal opioid overdoses have gone down, which is good, but that doesn't mean that marijuana doesn't come with its own problems. So in terms of counseling and monitoring, I agree with the caller. We need to be very, very careful.
And how about things like lung damage? If people, and this would be, I guess, smoking a lot of marijuana, does it hurt your lungs?
It seems like it should. I mentioned there were a couple
like
of surprises, and that was one. You'd think it would. You're inhaling the same kinds of stuff you inhale in tobacco, tar, particulates, just nasty stuff you don't want in your lungs. It turns out that there don't seem to be any long-term lung risk. There are some subtle changes in lung function tests for people who use a lot, meaning several joints a day. Nobody really sure why that is. The simplest explanation is probably the best, and it's a matter of dose. So for people to get long-term lung damage in the form of emphysema, many of the patients, when I work at the VA, years ago I took care of guys who had smoked two or three packs a day for 20 or 30 years. And wound up with significant lung damage. But imagine what kind of shape you'd be in if you smoked 20 or 40 joints a day for 20 or 30 years. Your lungs would be the least of your problems. So it may be that in the doses that people usually get, a joint a day, lung damage or forms of lung cancer or throat cancer don't seem to be a risk.
Is there a connection between perhaps repeated use of marijuana, even for medical reasons, and brain damage? Is there a connection there?
You mentioned for medical use, and we really don't have enough experience with medical use, so that to me is a wide open question. The data we have on long-term changes in thinking, memory, and brain structure come from recreational users. And what you think of those data depends, I think, in partly on what your bias is. I tried to come at this with an open mind, and I'm not sure. I'm not convinced there's a smoking gun that we definitely know that chronic use causes brain changes, but I think that is still a risk based on what I've seen. The problem with a lot of those studies is people use lots of other drugs, and it's hard to disarticulate them sometimes.
Let me see what Lisa from media has to say. Lisa, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This is a really important subject for a number of reasons. In my family, my father was born in 1917, used marijuana in the 50s and 60s, and he didn't use it recreationally. He used it recreationally in the sense that on his own, and I believe he suffered from ADHD and ADD before those things were diagnosed. And I'm curious if there's any research on recreational users or users of marijuana, you know, prior to the past, you know, few decades, who had to self-medicate because it calmed him, and he probably, the only thing that made him mellow. He did not use other drugs, and he was not a drinker. So I'm really interested if there's any research in that area.
Now, Lisa, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. The use of marijuana to deal with ADD or ADHD. David?
I don't know. I haven't seen clinical trials. The global point there that I think is important is that a lot of people, I think, turn to medical marijuana to self-medicate for a variety of either psychiatric disorders or low-grade psychiatric diagnoses like ADHD or anxiety. And we don't really know much about why people turn to those. The one thing I'd point out that we all need to be careful about is that there have been some studies pointing to associations, say, between marijuana use and anxiety, which may be true.
But, mean they're connected?
Well, in theory.
In theory,
another
okay.
explanation is that people who begin suffering anxiety self-medicate with marijuana. And if you look at a population, it could look like they're the same. It would be sort of like if you found an association between the use of ibuprofen and arthritis. Well, ibuprofen doesn't cause arthritis. It's just that people with arthritis have pain and they use ibuprofen. So there are these studies showing that there might be a link, but you don't really know what the causality is. My interpretation is there might be a link, but I think a lot of people tend to self-medicate. And I think what the caller is describing is probably very common and appears in those sorts of studies, although we don't know for sure.
Lisa, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You did look, or some people have looked at post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, and marijuana. Again, What's the latest on that?
Well, unfortunately, we don't really know. And I say unfortunately because that's one of the most common uses that I ran across in interviewing patients in clinics and dispensaries. It's a condition that a lot of people are turning to marijuana for. It's a condition that people are turning away from the health system for because the drugs they're being prescribed cause side effects. Many people tell me they're unpleasant or they don't work. And so there's a large sense in many of the patients I talk to of desperation turning to medical marijuana, as was the case in one patient whose story I described in
yeah.
detail.
Yeah.
But we really don't know. There have been a couple of small studies, one retrospective study asking people, well, when you started using marijuana, did it make you feel better? One prospective clinical trial that was done in Israel. They used very, very high concentrations, about 20% of THC in that marijuana, and reported some improvement. But there haven't been, to my knowledge, randomized controlled trials. Sue Sisley, who is a physician in Arizona, has been trying to do these trials for a while, but keeps running into regulatory roadblocks because it's a Schedule I substance and so on. So there's definitely interest in doing these randomized controlled trials. We need them. Mm-hmm. Until then, I think people are taking their best guess and trying.
Well, we're almost having a break here, but it's so interesting listening to you and also reading the book and reading some of these anecdotes, how much of this is a really patient-centered movement, if I can call it that, and perhaps frustration with the rest of our medical system, taking things into their own hands.
I think that's a lot of it. The New York Times op-ed piece that you mentioned that came out 2 days ago makes that argument. I think it's partly dissatisfaction with medical things like symptom management, but it's also dissatisfaction, I think, with the way our current health system is set up and the lack of patient-centeredness and the opportunity that people have to go into a dispensary, to have a real relationship, to take control over their health care.
Another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about medical marijuana in this hour of Radio Times. Our guest is David Casseret. He's a palliative care physician here in Philadelphia and the author of a new book called Stoned, A Doctor's Case for Medical Marijuana. A couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. See a bunch of emails, radiotimes@whyy.org. Tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. And if you're just joining us, David Casseret, our guest, we've been talking about medical marijuana. He was, a couple of years ago, rather skeptical about the use of medical marijuana or the effectiveness of it, decided to go find out for himself whether it works or not, and under what conditions, including using some medical marijuana for himself. He's a palliative care physician here in Philadelphia. Excuse me, also at the University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. As a palliative care physician, do you find a lot of your patients do use medical marijuana, whether prescribed or not?
Right. It's hard to tell. Mm-hmm. I'm in Pennsylvania where medical marijuana is not yet legal. I certainly have, in the process of writing this book, started to pay attention when patients ask me in general ways what else might help them. When patients tell me, well, I've heard about medical marijuana, do you think that might help me? I'm always careful to clarify that I can't recommend mm-hmm. it because mm-hmm. it's illegal here. But I've become more open to walking them through, without providing a recommendation, walking them through what we know. And I've been surprised by how many people tell me, I'm glad to hear you say that because I've been using it for the last couple of months and it works well. They didn't open with that. They didn't tell me that up front. But I think for every person who tells me that they are using it, mm-hmm. there are probably many more who are curious to see what I think but aren't going to divulge that.
You did try a couple of, I think, some wine that was laced with marijuana, some beer. I mean, there are, I guess, some substances where marijuana has absolutely no effect whatsoever.
Well, it's not a matter of no effect, right? But there's actually an interesting science to trying to get the active ingredients of medical marijuana, THC, CBD, other cannabinoids, out of the plant and into some form in which you can use it. And you mentioned that I did try tea, beer, and wine, and I did that very strategically because the science of how you get THC out of a bud is really kind of boring. I mean, it's fascinating if you're a geek like me, but if you just want to know how to use it, it's boring. And so I tried to tell stories in a way that made it more interesting and engaging. And the short summary is that in order to get those active ingredients out of marijuana, you need something that THC or CBD like to dissolve in. In general, that's high concentrations of alcohol or fats, lipids, like butter or oil.
Like brownies, right?
Brownies. So the recipes out there that seem to be effective at getting those active ingredients out of the bud into some form in which you can ingest it involve things like butter or olive oil or high concentrations of alcohol. Not tea, not beer, not wine. But I met a dispensary owner who also shared his wife's recipe for marijuana-infused butter as part of a linguine and clam sauce recipe. Which
did you try?
I did not.
You did
I didn't
not.
Try the brownie recipe either. I'm not a recreational user.
Unlike Maureen Dowd, who apparently went to Colorado and...
Overdoubted, I think is the technical term for it.
On brownies. We have a comment actually from Dan. We talked about this earlier, but he says, can you talk about the difference between THC and CBD-based marijuana used for pain control?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think initially most of the studies of marijuana for pain control focused on THC. There were, though, some studies that used dronabinol, which is the synthetic form of THC in pill form, that didn't find any evidence of pain relief, really pretty underwhelming. And so that's made researchers like Barth Wilsey at UC Davis, an anesthesiologist, interested in the possibility that you could actually get a lot of pain relief, maybe all of the pain relief that you'd get with marijuana, by decreasing the amount of THC down to pretty much nothing and increasing the concentration of CBD. And if that's true, and he's doing some clinical trials now that push marijuana in that direction, if that's true, then you could get all of the pain relief, particularly for neuropathic pain, without any of the high euphoric effects, which may not be for everybody. Some people want that as part of their improved quality of life. But for people who want to stay awake and alert, don't want to be impaired, which is many of the patients I take care of as well, that could be hugely beneficial too.
What about driving and marijuana?
I was actually quite flabbergasted when one of my patients told me that he was using medical marijuana that he acquired illegally for neuropathic pain. It was very effective for him, but he told me he was also driving, and worse, he was driving his son to school. And so partly to get a sense of just how impairing that was, and also as an intervention to show him, we went to a parking lot on a deserted weekend afternoon outside of Philadelphia. I laid out a series of obstacles in the form
of bananas.
I didn't plan ahead. I couldn't find traffic cones.
So you picked bananas. Okay,
he navigated his aged Honda Civic through this obstacle course and did a really horrendous job. Horrendous enough so that he was convinced that smoking and driving didn't mix. And actually in studies that have been conducted in driving simulators, the data are really pretty clear that within the first at least 2 to 3 hours, probably up to 6 hours after a dose of marijuana, people have trouble paying attention. They tend to overcompensate. They tend to pay attention on the wrong things. They have a hard time focusing, and they have a hard time prioritizing, and they don't drive very well.
I mean, equal to alcohol, although it sounds like maybe more long-lasting than alcohol?
Maybe longer-lasting, although that varies from person to person. One interesting difference, though, and this should not be taken as advice to go out and smoke and drive, but whereas alcohol tends to decrease your inhibitions, making you more likely to take risks and be reckless, marijuana smoking tends to slow people down and make them more cautious. So there is a little bit of built-in safety, but not enough to make it okay to get anywhere near the wheel of a car after you've ingested or inhaled.
Don't drive and smoke marijuana. From a comment from Ellen saying, did you study any links between Alzheimer's and using medical marijuana treatment for it? Are people looking at that? Is that an area worth exploring?
It may be down the road. I think of that, which, I mean, we know Alzheimer's affects millions of patients, and it's a growing problem. Colleagues of mine, like Jason Karlowish at the University of Pennsylvania, are very interested in understanding what the growth in Alzheimer's disease means for a population as the population ages. So it's a huge public health problem. There's some limited evidence that some of the cannabinoids in marijuana might reduce inflammation, may have some role in reducing plaque and tangle formation, but it's still data that are on a very preliminary level, in the same way that we have some preliminary evidence that maybe some cannabinoids might slow tumor growth in test tubes and cell culture, but we're not nearly at the stage where we could begin to think about clinical trials.
We have some other comments here. Does the guest have any thoughts about marijuana for hospice patients? I mean, you, in many ways, that's what you do. You deal with hospice patients, and you mentioned the fact that sometimes with a little questioning from you, they will tell you about the use of marijuana, their use of marijuana.
I guess two answers to that. One is many of the symptoms that we run across in hospice, things like loss of appetite, like muscle spasms, neuropathic pain, certainly nausea, those are constellations of symptoms for which there's probably the most evidence for medical marijuana. The other reason, so I think it makes sense to think about medical marijuana use in patients who are in hospice, certainly. The other reason it makes sense is that if there are long-term risks of medical marijuana, probably not in terms of lung damage, maybe in terms of psychiatric illness, although we don't know, maybe in terms of other things that are pretty hypothetical, like heart attacks or strokes, for patients in hospice, those are really not an issue. So I don't mean to dismiss all risks for patients in hospice. Certainly, many of my patients in hospice, not as many as I'd like, but some of them do live for months or years. So I wouldn't dismiss those risks. But I'm less worried about those risks for hospice patients than I am for some of the patients I met in researching stoned, like a 24-year-old guy who was using marijuana for PTSD-related symptoms. You know, he may be using marijuana for those symptoms for years or decades. And if there are risks related to cognitive function or memory or mental illness, if there are those risks, he'd be facing those risks potentially.
Let me get back to the calls at 1-888-477-9499. Looks like we have Genevieve from Allentown. Genevieve, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I am a high school teacher, and a lot of my students have the, I think, misconception that because marijuana is used in medicine, it's perfectly fine for anybody to take, that it's the healthiest option, even compared to alcohol. And I teach biology, so I try to, like, hit on it a little bit, but it's kind of a risky topic to talk about in terms of how their parents, you know, think of me. I don't want to talk about it too much. But is there anything you'd recommend, like, you know, some statistics you could give in terms of the adolescent brain? And is it true that adolescents hold THC in their systems a lot longer than adults do? And what is the effect there?
Genevieve, a great call, and what a great teacher to be able to take this on. Go ahead, David.
Yeah, I'm definitely glad you're out there. I wish we had more teachers like you when I went to medical school, because it sounds like your students are learning more about marijuana, medical marijuana, than I learned in medical school. I think the short answer in terms of statistics, one of the ones that I worry about a lot is the 1 in 10, more or less, figure for addiction that I mentioned before. The other thing, the other statistic, if you will, is really an open question mark. We don't really know that much. There certainly have been reports of, and some smaller studies of long-term effects in terms of thinking and memory with adolescent recreational use. We don't really know. I think a huge amount of caution is probably the best approach to take. I will say that I've heard what you're hearing from your students from many people, many older, more responsible people. One dispensary owner told me that, of course, marijuana is perfectly safe. It comes from a flower. It's not like morphine, forgetting apparently that morphine is an opioid. Opioids come from poppies, and poppies are also flowers. So there is this misconception that because it's natural, it's safe, or because it's a medicine, it's safe. And you could think of lots of medicines from morphine to chemotherapy that are far from safe. So I think part of my goal in writing Stoned is not just to explore the medical benefits, but to try to get on the table the fact that there are risks ranging from addiction to risks of driving and others that we need to at least take seriously.
Genevieve, thanks for the call to Radio Times. As I said, you began as a skeptic. You're not a proponent necessarily. Are you something in the middle, which is that we need to take this blood flower, this plant, this drug more seriously, and perhaps even take it out of a Schedule I designation so that we can do more and better research on it?
Sure. I think there are probably a couple things we need to do. Certainly rescheduling it to Schedule II. Some people would argue taking it off the schedule entirely. I don't see that happening, although I appreciate the arguments there. Right. So taking it off of Schedule I so research is more feasible, encouraging federal funding on research. Again, funding both for research into benefits, but also risks. you ask whether I'm a proponent of medical marijuana, I think of medical marijuana as a tool, as a set of molecules that are effective to varying degrees for varying conditions. So I'm not a proponent of morphine per se, but for patients with advanced cancer pain who are having significant pain that's impairing their function, I'm a fan of morphine. I think of marijuana in the same way. It's not a cure-all for everybody, but for some conditions, it really is either an adjuvant in addition to other drugs, or it may be somebody's best option.
Let me get, looks like Kay from Bucks County to join us on Radio Times. And Kay, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I was calling because I have rheumatoid arthritis, and I had decided a couple of years ago to basically experiment on myself with marijuana. What I found was that while it didn't necessarily help me very much with my pain, it did help with the side effects of the drugs that one is frequently prescribed for rheumatoid arthritis, which are basically low-dose chemotherapy for the rest of your life. It's called methotrexate, and it causes dizziness, nausea, vomiting, all of those lovely things.
Oh,
and
yeah.
If I ingest marijuana with it, most of those symptoms pretty much disappear, except the fatigue, which is kind of expected.
Right, that's interesting.
That's pretty much it.
No, I appreciate the call, Kay, and I'd like to hear what David Casarenas is saying.
That's fascinating. And I think this is a great example of why we need more and better crowdsourced research. As I've said before, most of the clinical trials on just nausea, to use one example, have been nausea related to chemotherapy. But there are a lot of other drugs that cause nausea, and there are a lot of other symptoms and side effects of treatment. We could require decades, literally, to do clinical trials for all of those. And so in researching stoned, I've become a big fan of finding ways to better crowdsource research. I work with some students at Penn to create a website, marijuanaresults.org, that would let patients share their stories. Most importantly, to me at least, as a researcher, to let patients share stories like yours with researchers. If you see two reports of marijuana helping with, say, nausea associated with methotrexate, well, that's interesting. But if you see 100 reports or 200 reports, then any researcher worth his or her tenure would start thinking, well, you know, we should do a randomized controlled trial here.
Final, I just want to squeeze in one more question before we have to say goodbye here, because we have a lot of people that had questions or have questions. This is from Jeff saying, Delaware just passed a law allowing medical marijuana for minors in treating of epilepsy. Thought about the safety of the pediatric population and use for this, whether that's indicated or not. Anything you can say in 30 seconds or less?
Yeah, it's a great question. I don't know the Delaware law. In general, when quote-unquote marijuana is used for pediatric epilepsy, it's not marijuana. It's concentrated CBD or cannabidiol, which doesn't have any psychoactive effects. So in terms of safety, CBD is probably, parents have told me, much safer than any of the other drugs. That's certainly what I heard from Cal and Cindy about their decision to treat Randy. Again, we don't know whether it works, but for many parents who have been through sometimes a dozen drugs and six neurologists, something that's safe, even if it may not be the solution, is their best bet.
Well, David Casarenas, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. Much to talk about and think about.
Oh, thanks. Been my pleasure.
Our pleasure as well. The book is called Stoned, A Doctor's Case for Medical Marijuana. He's a palliative care physician here in the Philadelphia area and affiliated with the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show, how to find us on Facebook, how to follow us on Twitter, how to listen to us on satellite radio, also how to sign up for our newsletter, a full-service operation here at Radio Times. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show. This show was produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.